All right, members, we are going to start. We will make sure we don't take a vote until we have a quorum. We're very close at this point, and Representative Biskins has checked in, so we're very close to a quorum. So I would ask you, Representative Sharon, Representative Mesler, would you like to introduce our...
I'm sorry.
Did you ask somebody? Good.
I asked somebody to move the bill.
Good. Wonderful. Thank you. All right. House file 3232, great number, is before the committee for consideration for the omnibus bill. Would you please go ahead, Representative Sharon, and explain your bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. First of all, Madam Chair, I do have an amendment, an author's amendment.
Okay.
And if I can get somebody to move the bill, then move the amendment.
All right.
So move.
Okay. The amendment and the bill have been... The amendment has been moved by Representative Brown.
Yeah, I just would like the amendment to get the bill in the shape I'd like it.
What
the amendment does is send this... this bill is about a study, and we want to send the study out for an RFP instead of having the department do it. We've talked with members of the department.
Until yesterday, we thought the department was going to do this study without any additional cost, and that was what we were told all along. This morning, I found out that now they've decided there is a cost. So it's a little late to come along with a cost, I think, but that's what happened.
But luckily, I had the amendment prepared in advance.
Fortunately, yes. I appreciate that. And all those in favor of the amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Let's see. Did we have enough people to vote on that amendment? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And Mark, 6. Okay. Go ahead, Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, I've learned a lot in my first session down here, although I keep insisting to the speaker that I be given credit for two terms after this last session. And we have a lot of differing ideas here, and there's a lot of passionate debate, but there are some things I know we do agree on. I think we can be very confident saying that everyone here wants the best education possible for our children. And I think we can be very confident in saying that everyone here wants to make sure we provide the resources for our children's education. We recognize it's one of our chief charges. And we also recognize that all school districts don't fit in the same mold. You can't put a cookie cutter on a district. And so we recognize that different districts have different challenges. We recognize, for example, through sparsity revenue, that our rural schools have different challenges than, say, our inner city schools that get compensatory revenue, that have different challenges than our outstate cities or our suburban cities. What I would like to do with House File 3232 is to look at the cost differences of doing business in different school districts around the state, specifically when it comes to labor costs in different districts, because there seem to be different demands from different areas of the state on labor costs. So what we would like to do with House File 3232 is to commission a study to see just that, to see if there is a difference, and if so, where those differences are. And that's all the bill simply does, is ask for a study.
Okay.
With me is Scott Kronquist with the Association of Metropolitan School Districts.
I should mention, too, if you recall, the Governor's Task Force on School Funding and I think it was John Meyer's study that we heard, a few months ago? It was during the interim, I believe. Both recommended that there should be something done about cost differences, that was one of the things missing in our funding formula. And so this is just a discussion of that and asking, it was going to be the department, doing an RFP to look at this and figure out how you might recognize it. And I guess like everything else, we don't recognize every piece to 100%, but there would be some recognition somewhere, hopefully in our formula, that would recognize cost differences as well as we recognize sparsity, poverty, all those other factors, equity, aid as well. And Mr. Kronquist, you're up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Scott Kronquist with the Association of Metropolitan School Districts. And in your packet, there should be a handout of a brief PowerPoint presentation. And I'll run through that on the screen as well. But I'd like to, first of all, thank Representative Sharon for bringing this issue forward. We really appreciate his leadership on this and his willingness to bring this issue to you today. And this is an issue that you have seen before. I think you would probably recall last year there was a bill that actually established a particular method for addressing this. And as Representative Sharon has indicated, this actually is asking for a study, recognizing that this is not a funding year, but to prepare you with information next year when you come back to be able to make that decision on whether or not this is something that we should pursue as a state. As Representative Sikora, Chair Sikora mentioned, really any school finance expert around the country will tell you that when you're designing a formula, you need to recognize differences. And they really break down into two different types of differences. There's student differences based on the demographics of the student, ranging from special education students to students that are in severe poverty to students that don't speak English as a first language. And then there are also differences that impact school districts. And those tend to again, come down along the lines of demographic or geographic differences. But it's differences that are beyond the control of the school district. For example, small, rural, isolated districts have higher costs, and just naturally, in order for them to offer the same programs. And another difference that exists is labor costs. And labor costs are 75 to 80% of a school district's budget. So even small differences in labor costs can have a tremendous impact on the school district budget. So with that in mind, I would just ask you to look at the first slide in the PowerPoint presentation. And you'll see that in Minnesota, actually, even though we'd hear a lot of criticism about our funding formula and how complex it is and how it probably needs to be overhauled, and a lot of that may be true, because it has been tweaked a lot over the years. But I would argue that the underpinnings really provide a solid foundation and do recognize many of those differences that school finance experts say need to be recognized. If you take out basic education aid, which, as you know, is the same amount for everyone, every school district, every student generates that $47.83 per pupil. And then if you eliminate looking at referendum temporarily, now you're looking at the different categorical revenues, and you can see what differences we do recognize in Minnesota. You can see we recognize compensatory revenue, again, directed at students that are in poverty. Sparsity is an issue, again, that impacts rural school districts, small rural districts. Likewise, transportation sparsity recognizes the higher transportation costs we have for many of our districts in rural Minnesota. On and on. But the one thing you see that is not here, or that I shouldn't say you see, one thing that is missing here that you don't see, is something that would recognize the labor cost differential. And turning your attention to the next slide, you can see that in Minnesota we do in fact have a significant differential when it comes to the cost of labor. First of all, if we look at the private sector variance, now this is excluding education-related jobs, looking at things like auto mechanics, construction, electricians, lawyers down the line. You can see that in the 7-county metro area, the average hourly wage is actually 31.7% higher than it is in the non-metro. Well, it should not really be a big surprise then that if you look at education-related positions, you would see also a variance. But you will notice, in fact, that the I'm sorry.
Mr. Kronquist, could I just ask you, what are you considering metro? Is it 11 counties or 7?
The 7-county metro area, Madam Chair.
7, okay.
Yeah. And in looking at this information, you can see that actually in the education area, that salary differential has been compacted. It's actually significantly less than it is in the private sector area. But if you do look at the different positions that school districts need to hire, teachers, pupil support, office staff, food service, administrators, the average difference in the hourly wage is 18.2%. Again, when you consider the fact that 75 to 80% of a school district's budget is tied up in salary and benefits, you can get a pretty quick grasp on what impact that has on the school district's budget. Well, how are we, in fact, then addressing this right now? Because the wage differences do exist. What are metro districts doing to try to address that? Well, here, if you go back to an earlier slide.
Excuse me, Mr. Kronquist. Yeah. Representative Erickson had a question.
Thank you, Chair Sikora. Mr. Kronquist, you combined custodians, transportation, and technology. Isn't that quite a stretch to figure out a differential? Because I think those vary greatly in districts, whether they're in greater Minnesota or the metro area.
Mr. Kronquist.
Madam Chair, this is the way the data comes from the Department of Economic Security. So it's just taking the data that's provided.
Go ahead.
Moving on, if you add in the referendum component, you get an idea then how metro districts are attempting to compensate for those labor cost differentials. And you can see the heavy reliance in other metro districts, those would be the suburban districts. Again, I should have pointed out earlier, across the bottom, you can see the GM, less than 500, that stands for Greater Minnesota Districts, under 500 student enrollment, and moving across, this is how the Department of Education breaks districts down and breaks the data down. And so you can see, again, the heavy reliance, the suburban districts and the urban districts on the referendum, and really what those referendum dollars are going to pay for is the higher cost of labor. And in fact, that does put a lot of pressure on property taxpayers, because in the metro area, when they do pass the referendum, you can see in the suburban districts, 87% of that is falling on the property taxpayers.
Representative Newman. Momentarily forgot your name.
You know, that gives me confidence, Madam Chair. Given the fact that this bill is for a study, and it almost looks to me like your study has already been completed, in that the charts that you're going through appear to clearly be showing that you need more money in the metro area and not as much money in the rural areas. And I will tell you that the rural schools are struggling just like everyone else. If you've already come to these conclusions that you need more money in the metro area to take away from the rural areas, why do we need to study them?
Perhaps you ought to clarify the reason for the study? Representative Sharon?
Madam Chair, Representative Newman, I guess I would take issue with that we want to take money away from the rural area and give it to the metro area, first of all.
Madam Chair, well, yeah, I agree wholeheartedly. That is not what the bill from last year said that Representative Sharon authored, and certainly not, there's nothing in the current language that would say that. We're definitely not arguing that there's too much money in rural Minnesota school districts. We are pointing out the need, and we do feel the evidence is pretty compelling. The study, though, there are different ways you can address this.
If I may, Madam Chair.
Representative Newman.
If the information that you have is compelling, why do we need to study them? It looks to me like you already have the information.
Madam Chair, Representative Newman, the study would bring forth information and recommendations on how to address it. There are a variety of ways you can address it. About a dozen districts around the country do have adjustments in their formula to recognize labor cost differentials. Those states have approached it from a variety of ways, and so that would be included in the study and the recommendations. I would assume the department would verify these results, but we think, again, that the analysis is pretty compelling. If they agree, then they would need to take the next step and offer recommendations on how you move forward and address it.
Fair enough. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative Kronquist, you wouldn't want to be one of us, would you? Please go ahead, Mr. Kronquist.
Actually, Madam Chair, that was the end of my presentation. So I'd be happy.
Did you cover the last one, too? Okay.
Yeah, the last one just showed, again, when you put that kind of pressure on the property taxpayers in the metro area, there's very little referendum equalization. And so when they do pass a referendum, it is falling largely on the property taxpayers.
We heard similar, really a similar issue last week on the bill of yours, and also one by Lanning that looks at the equalization for debt service. So we have kind of running into some of the same issues across the board. Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Chair Sakura. Mr. Kronquist, I really think if and when you do the study, that you have to include the 11 county area rather than 7, because where the area where I represent, which is just north of Elk River School District, that's definitely, you know, metro more than it is greater Minnesota today. And I think that would be appropriate for that whole circle, that outer ring of suburbs. So you might want to consider that if this goes forth.
Madam Chair, Representative Erickson, that's a very legitimate point, and I don't think the bill would prohibit that. In fact, it does encourage the department to examine labor cost differentials that exist in different regions of the state. And so you're exactly right. There may very well need to be adjustments that are made in other areas other than the 7 county metro area.
Representative Grilling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Sharon, I just want to say, as the members of the committee, I strongly support this bill. You know, we always are trying on this committee to find the most equitable education funding that we can. And the more we try, the more something pops up. But I think we always should be striving for perfection. And as soon as you have something that's inequitable, then the money that we provide to whatever area of the state has higher costs in that area, whether it's sparsity or wage differentials, then those students, which is what we're always after, is equity for students, don't get the same chance to have their programs funded like other students in other areas of the state. And some people would say we should just do a flat funding for all areas of the state and quit trying so hard on equity. And I would say, we should do both. But I would never be one. I would always fight tooth and nail, Representative Newman, for sparsity, you know, for your type of district, because I think it's fair. And hopefully when we get done with this study, you will think the same. Of course, you'll be off being a judge by then. But those of us who are left here will think the same about the regions of the state. And it might be Representative Erickson's region as well, not just the region that I live in.
Representative Bernardi.
And Representative Sharon, I just want to make a comment on this, too. I'm glad that you brought this forward, and Mr. Kronquist. I would like the study to analyze, because I think they might actually find out that these school districts and AMSD have larger class sizes than probably the rest of the state. And if we had the right funding levels, we wouldn't have to have the class sizes of, just had them visit, Moundsview visited the other day, and second grade, 31 kids in a classroom. And my daughter's class sizes are 5th, 6th, 7th grade are 35, 36 kids. So I bet if we could address this issue, our class sizes would go down.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Chair Sakura. I really think it's more important for us to look at ways that we can stop doing the Band-Aid approach. I've always been a little disappointed that we didn't venture forth with Governor Pawlenty's task force suggestions last year, because even if we would take up Representative Sharon's bill and make it law, we're still going to be separating ourselves into, I think, rural and metro, because rural Minnesota, that which is really and truly rural, is going to continue to have fewer students because there are fewer jobs. So, you know, I think as an education committee, we should try to look at a major overhaul reform of our funding rather than constantly look at these Band-Aids, and that's just my comment.
Well, I guess maybe every categorical is a Band-Aid of sorts. And, you know, we keep putting Band-Aids over Band-Aids, perhaps, but do you have a better idea? Because things do keep changing, just like the property values that have gone up so fast in rural Minnesota. That's, you know, in the last few years, and that's creating, you know, all sorts of additional issues. So it just seems like nothing ever stays the same and things are always changing. And that's why I think we should be open to looking at our formulas all the time to see what needs to be changed to address some of these issues. Whereas, you know, we've not ever been willing to look at compensatory, for example. Is it enough? Is it too much? Should we have the same kind of, what am I trying to say? That yeah, the same for every larger percent you have, it grows exponentially, that kind of thing. Is that the right way to be doing it?
Concentration.
Same concentration formula. You could have helped me out on that.
Yeah.
Nothing ever stays the same, and so we're always dealing with it. And in a way, you're right, but in a way, that's just the way it is, and we have to kind of take them as they come. Are there any other comments on this bill? If not, this bill will be laid over for possible inclusion, and I want to look
Madam
at the
Chair,
amendment. One more.
I think we did have somebody on the list that I...
Oh, excuse me. The somebody is sitting down at the table. I want to have another vote on the amendment because Representative Sharon had an amendment, and there weren't substantial people in the room as yet because some of you were very late getting to committee today. So therefore, there weren't quite the number of members here that should have been here. So all those in favor of the amendment, which asks for the RFP, asks for the RFP for the study, please say aye.
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 Opposed?
Aye.
Okay.
Madam Chair?
Amendment adopted.
Just a clarification. You said that we didn't have substantial people in the room at the time. You did mean substantial numbers of people.
We have only skinny people in the room is what I meant. Good, Representative Meadows. We've had a couple skinny people walk in, so nobody was very substantial around here. Representative Demmer is not present. Representative Newman, would you like to take the committee while my bill is here? Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Allswater. Ms. Allswater. I forgot that you wanted to testify. I have heard you were not. In fact, we had you on the list, and then I heard you were not going to testify, so.
You're right, Madam Chair, members of the committee, Jan Allswager, Education Minnesota. I did take my name off to testify for a moment, and then there were some comments made. I just thought I would follow up with some additional comments. And I actually would like to commend Representative Erickson for the comments that she made about taking a look at the whole education funding system. And we would wholeheartedly support your thoughts about trying to look at the funding system. And while this might be a good study to do, this is the main point that I want to make. If the study comes out with certain conclusions about the cost of living in certain areas, specifically the labor costs, I think the one question you have to ask yourself is, was that the right labor cost for that area or for that profession? For example, we would say that if you go to if you have a four-year degree and additional education as well, you should be starting out as a teacher making $40,000. And we have some of our teachers starting out making far less than that, and some of them at the end of their career after teaching 30 years might be lucky if they hit $50,000. So my point is basically this. When you put them into, if the study goes through and you put them into various categories based on their labor costs in a regional area, are we going to then kind of pigeonhole them into that geographical labor cost or that amount? So that's, you might want to consider having some minimum qualifications in terms of salaries because that is what that profession deserves. And we'd be more than happy to talk to people as this goes forward.
So, Ms. Allswager, your suggestion would be to set some minimum salaries for some regions?
Well,
not leave it up to school districts?
Madam Chair, I think Education Minnesota would like to see all of teachers start with $40,000. Certainly that should be locally negotiated. And I know that I just bring that up as a point in reference to this bill, not specifically what that requirement should be, but I think that there should be some consideration about whether or not teachers are below where they should be in an area.
Ms. Oswalker, how many teachers, how many school districts are teachers at 40 right now?
Madam Chair, I don't know if any do at this point.
Oh, okay. Okay, thank you.
Madam Chair?
I'm sorry, Representative Dorn.
Oh, I didn't know if my name was on the list or not, but...
No, it wasn't.
Oh.
It was, and we forgot.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. And I was kind of wondering along the same line of if the bill allows the flexibility for the study, for the recommended adjustment, is it possible for them to recommend an adjustment that would bring the wages of the non-metro teachers up to the level of the metro teachers, so we get that wage equity for all the teachers through the state? Is that one of the options they could, that they're free to recommend?
Perhaps then, would you like to get the cost of living in the metro area down to what it is in the rural area, so that we could all be equal?
They could recommend that too. I just,
Madam Chair, Representative Dorn.
Representative Sharon.
Thank you. As a teacher for the last 25 years, I'll be the last one here in this room saying that teachers are paid way too much. I think that what we want to do is get the information, and there's many different ways and that we can use this information, and certainly your suggestion is one of them.
Okay. Thank you, Mr.
And Representative Dorm, I do think that QComp, you know, districts that go into QComp, that is one way of increasing pay for teachers. So that, you know, that is something that we have done, something with performance pay. It probably isn't perfect, but I think it's a really good start.
And I think, Madam Chair, I think a lot of districts are, I know my district is looking at it very seriously. They couldn't come to a clear conclusion in this round, but they're working very hard at what would make sense for them. So I think your assessment is accurate on that.
Representative Sharon, did you have any final comments?
No, thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Thank you very much. Your bill will be laid over for possible consideration in the omnibus bill, assuming we have one. Mr. Chairman, I would like to bring House File 3367 before the committee for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
And your Representative Sikora, please proceed.
What this is really another way of maybe looking at how UFAR's reports are done. The data would all go in as it does now, but then when it was printed out, it would be formatted in a way that would be a little more transparent and easy to understand. And so with that, I will turn it over to my two folks who will introduce themselves. Are you first?
Hello. My name is Ward Eames, and I'm a business owner and a member of the Hopkins LAC Business Task Force, which is a group of 66 business owners and senior executives who have spent 2 years now looking hard at financial reporting for the school districts. And I don't know if you're familiar with the school district's reporting completely, but when I came to have a child in the schools 13 years ago, I now have a graduate who goes to St. Thomas and one in North Junior High in Hopkins, I spent 13 years looking at these numbers, and let me tell you that Hopkins' financial report is 92 pages long. Hewlett Packard International financial report is 40 pages long. I tried to read it, I tried to look at it, I tried to figure it out, and every single time, every single year, I was flabbergasted at how complicated and how the format was not conducive to basic financial understanding by the citizens. Now, I believe that there are six people in this state that does understand it, and many of them probably are here. But that's about it. That the rest of it is very difficult. So I'd like to draw your attention to this form right here. And over the last 2 years, the Business Task Force, along with folks from school districts, business managers, superintendents, the Association of Metropolitan School Districts, put a task force together. And what we did was we took the UFARs, I call them UFARs because it's UFTA when you really think about 30,000 codes that these schools are dealing with, and tried to figure out a way to simply, easily understand, in this case, first in a one-page document, and then if you look at the next five to four pages, it goes into a little bit more detail, not 92 pages of a financial report. And it takes the UFARs and turns it into a uses of funds, source of funds, basic financial statement that any business person who is familiar with financial reporting would be able to understand, and many, many, many people who like looking at graphs to get their relationships and numbers can also look at and have an interesting and important discussion with any school district personnel to understand the finances of a school district. I'm going to turn the details of this over to my cohort, Tom Berge from Minnetonka, but let me tell you why I think this is so important for us. The last thing we want in our public education system, and in fact in all of government, is the feeling of obfuscation, the feeling, the myth that we don't really want you to know the numbers, so we're going to make it really difficult for you to understand what they are. That's the last thing they want. We have done this format. Over 50 districts have now taken it on, done it themselves. It takes about 8 hours for a school district to translate their numbers. It's a simple Excel spreadsheet that once they put in their numbers, they then have a printout that looks just like this, that have all of the various different benchmarks and most important things that you want to know about a school district. What we're asking is that with this simple spreadsheet, which we've made available again to 50 different districts, have all used it, takes about 8 hours, easy. Every single school district that we've ever heard of is all for doing this, and we have examples of this. You can check it out. We've presented to the business community, tried it out. We vetted it with the Department of Ed, and they looked at it and said, yep, that's doable. And it's a simple spreadsheet that we've made available for free. And what we're asking is that could you possibly have the state, with all the numbers that are rolling up automatically right now, translate into this so that every one of us, looking at our own school districts, looking at districts around us, looking at rural districts and like districts, can compare apples to apples in an easy, logical, and business-friendly format. And I'm going to turn it over to Tom, with your permission, Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Deems. Mr. Berge, state your name and please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. My name is Tom Berge. I'm Director of Finance and Operations for Minnetonka Schools. And our goal in presenting the information today is to come up with a reporting format that effectively communicates how a school district operates, how, in other words, to report its operations to the public in a way that's easy to understand. One of the difficulties that we have with UFARS is that it's essentially a cost accounting system, if you will. It reflects what's being spent on specific areas, but doesn't really report things in a operational format that the public can understand very easily. It uses a lot of jargon, it's long, it's confusing, and possibly there's school district accountants, some board members, and some superintendents that fully understand what's in a comprehensive annual report. And as a result, there are sometimes misleading conclusions that are drawn from the current reporting format. I've heard people say, well, only half your budget goes to instruction. looking just at regular instruction, which runs about 50 to 55% out of a school district's operating budget. It doesn't include special education. It doesn't include instruction support. It doesn't include media. But they'll say, well, just 50%. Very misleading. There's people now come up with the 65% solution or the 70% solution. And any variety of different solutions off of the existing format. And what we did was to take a look at how the private sector reports its operations. And having worked in the private sector and having taught accounting at Mankato State for a couple years, went back and took a look at exactly what the profit and loss statement is, the operating statement is for a private business. And they report their costs in two major categories, cost of goods sold and general and administrative expenses. And the cost of goods sold includes all costs that are directly related to the production or to the purchase of what a company sells. And it includes not only the direct labor and material, but it includes utilities, plant maintenance, plant management, delivery costs, insurance, supplies, whatever it takes to manufacture or to put that product on the shelf. And we feel there's a parallel in education, and we refer to it as the cost of teaching and learning. And what we're looking at is to take the same accounting principles that are applied in the private sector and apply them to a school district's financial report. And we've accomplished this by using existing UFARS data. We're not changing UFARS. We're not reformatting it. All we're doing is resorting the data into a new format. Main category, cost of teaching and learning. And the secondary category, general and administrative expenses. And the cost of teaching and learning includes all costs that are required to provide instruction. Costs incurred at the building level and at the district level. And general administrative include the district level administrative and support costs. Specifically, the cost of teaching and learning would include regular, what we know as regular instruction, special ed, vocational, instruction support, staff development. It would include the cost of operating the building utilities, custodial services. Can't really provide instruction unless you heat the classroom and you keep the classroom clean. The operating capital expenses for equipment and facilities, that's all related to instruction. And building administration, which is basically the leadership, the management of that particular site. These costs are included in the cost of teaching and learning. And when we take a look at what portion of the budget goes into teaching and learning, including the cost of transportation, it's roughly about 95% of the operating cost. As Mr. Ames has mentioned, we've presented this information to various groups around the metro and non-metro areas. We've taken it to the Chamber of Commerce. They like the report format. People who are on school boards with business backgrounds have looked at it and liked the format. As we said, the system has been tested. It's been used in a variety of districts. It's had a positive response, and we're not reinventing the system. Basically, we're taking the same data that is reported electronically to the state and reformatting that into a report that we feel is better representative and easier to read of a school district's operations. It's basically fairly simple to implement. Just a couple comments in regard to House File 3367. One suggestion I might have, if it's brought forward, is that rather than having two reporting dates, one reporting date after the audited material is submitted would be sufficient. And then in terms of a review committee, possibly having the UFARS Advisory Council, which is already a standing committee, finalize and work with the required report at the state level. Thank you for the opportunity to present.
Thank you, Mr. Berge. Representative Maslow, I've got Scott Cronquist down as a testifier. Would you step out in the hall and asking if he could come in. I saw him walk out with his telephone.
Certainly, Mr. Chair.
Representative Biskins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Berge, your references to the private sector a couple times brought something to mind that we heard in Committee on Governmental Operations today, and it has to do with accounting and auditing of local units of governments and their accounting procedures. Is there anywhere in this new and improved report where school districts' liabilities are tracked, both funded and unfunded, and the issue that this was brought forward to in governmental operations today was the issue that, according to the state auditor, more than half of the school districts in the state are looking at unfunded liabilities in post-retirement health care benefits that have been negotiated into contracts, and that's carried nowhere on the books. And I'm wondering if some of those issues are going to be part of the reporting that will come to light in your new system.
Mr. Berge?
Mr. Chair, Representative Biskins. This particular format is the operating statement for the school district. The issue that is raised by GASB 45, which is the new accounting standard requiring that governmental entities report unfunded liabilities for post-retirement benefits, is reflected on the balance sheet and is shown as a liability on the balance sheet. This doesn't deal with the balance sheet. This is just the annual operating statement. All districts, however, within the next 2 to 3 years, will have to be recognizing that liability on their books, having an actuarial analysis of the liability and having that reflected.
Representative Biskins. Mr. Chair, Mr. Berge, is it your understanding that they will also have to show how they are working to fund that liability, and if they are, then wouldn't that be considered part of the operating costs of running the district?
Mr. Berge.
Mr. Chair, Representative Biskins, that particular cost, the annual cost, the annual required contribution to fund the liability would be shown as a cost on the operating statement, and it would be shown as part of the employee benefits cost in operations.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Maslow, if my understanding, there was an oral amendment that was to be brought forward at this point.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As I look at the makeup of the task force, I would like to propose one addition to the task force, so that takes us to page 2, line 31. My request would be that following the reference to the Minnesota Rural Education Association, we insert the Minnesota School Board Association and then put a comma there. If we do adopt that change, then we would also, on line 26, need to change the task force from 11 members to 12 members. And so I would offer that amendment orally if that would be acceptable to the chair and to the author.
Representative Sikora, what's your position on the amendment?
I have no problem with that amendment, Mr. Chairman.
Any questions as to the amendment? Representative Flensy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had posed this question yesterday to Representative Sikora, and I just wondered if I could get a response from either the people up there or maybe the school administrators, why they would not be involved in the task force given their frequent use of this information and in setting up the budgets and proposing budgets to the school board. And so it's kind of in reference to, adding the school board, but I also had the question about the administration, and maybe you feel that that's covered with the business officials, but just wanted to know where the superintendents stand on this, since they usually do propose the budgets to the school boards.
Representative Sikora.
Actually, you know, I think it was maybe more an oversight than anything. I have no objection to the School Board Association having a representative, or the Superintendent's Association for that matter, but I think the idea was to keep it small enough it would get the job done.
Representative Flynn.
Thank you. I guess I understand the need to keep the task force small, but it seems that most of the people that would be sitting on this task force, with the exception of the school business officials, are not people who work in the day-to-day business of the school. So I just wanted to know what the philosophy or rationale was behind those folks who are being placed on the task force.
Mr. Berge.
Mr. Chair, Representative Klinzing, when I read the bill, my first reaction was similar to yours, that a lot of the people, a lot of the groups that are identified here are not regularly working with putting together the financial statements or the working with the business side of the school district operations. And there currently is a standing group. It's called the UFARS Advisory Committee that does work with that. It's a committee that is under the Department of Education, and that is made up of school district business officials and accounting people who are familiar with this. And my sense was that that group probably had the most expertise to take a look at the existing UFARS reports and determine exactly how they might be reformatted in the manner that we're representing here today.
To the amendment, are there any further comments or questions? Representative Meslow, would you please restate your amendment and then move on?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The two changes would be on page 2, line 26, at the end of the line, to change the number 11 to the number 12. And on page 2, line 31, following the comma after Education Association, to insert the Minnesota School Board Association and a comma there as well.
To the amendment, any further questions? All those in favor, signify by saying aye.
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 All those opposed? Amendment is adopted. To the bill as amended, are there any other individuals in the audience who wish to testify on this bill? And any other questions? Representative Bernard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've heard about you guys before, so I'm glad that you're here, and I'm glad that you brought them here, Chair Sikora. I'm interested in just briefly, what's your analysis that you came, what did you draw from all this? I had heard from you guys, I had heard through the grapevine that you discovered that and were able to articulate to people that school districts were in a black hole, that they were being very efficient and effective. Can you just make comments on anything that you've learned?
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Eames.
Yeah. Thank you for saying that you heard about us. It's really fun to put this in front of particularly business groups and business owners who, for the first time, go, aha, okay, so that's why there is this, that, or the other. The really cool or interesting thing about this is that over time, what you'll find is that you'll see the successful schools have certain profiles in terms of where their money's going and how it's being spent, and you'd be able to tell successful schools in a number of different ways, including the standardized tests and other graduation rates, etc. And if you look at the bottom part of these, and whether you look at it at the Austin one, which we supplied, or with Wilmer, or you start seeing these incredibly interesting benchmarks for class size. And you see the increases and decreases in enrollment and how that affects the cost per student. And you start seeing, if you just look in the upper right-hand corner, what percentage am I spending locally for this school? And they vary considerably between these three districts. How much Fed money am I getting? Yes, you can be specific about this grant, and this special situation, and that special situation. But when you look at 3 years, which is what this is also requiring, that you look 3 years, you see trends. No 1 year is a good financial reporting tool, because there are blips all over the place. So you see 3 years, you start seeing trends, and why is that administration number going up? You know, or why is that cost of the teachers' benefits going up? Well, sure enough, unfunded liabilities that may be there in the district that have to eventually come down through the financial statement here. So those are the fun, interesting, and business people get a kick out of seeing these in ways that they can understand it, as opposed to things, you know, I mean, just simply the way the reporting is now. When you look at a financial report, it adds to the right. You add things and you look to the right. That's just not the way most business people see it.
Any further questions, Representative Bernard?
No, that is fine. Thank you.
Thank you. It is, you know, easy to read and has some similarities to the youth bars, and you can see where it, I think, makes it, puts it in some more organized, into more organized fashion. One of the questions I have, though, is the cover letter where it talks about the product is education, and it's, and then you have a category called teaching and learning, and there was a reference made today in the testimony that all costs required to provide teaching and learning are then put into that category of education and put on the shelf as the product. It sounds to me like there's some assumptions being made in there that certain things must be there that maybe other schools are doing without in order to provide that education. And one of those things that was mentioned is lunch, and I know some of the charter schools are going to, you know, they're not offering lunches, they're having students bring lunches in. Another issue that's come up is transportation. There's an assumption that that cost must be incurred, and I think statutorily that may be the case here. But there are some private schools that are going to a situation where they're not providing transportation. There are things in this definition, like classroom aides, and the cost of those must be incurred in order to provide teaching and learning and put that education product on the shelf. I'm not getting at taking any, you know, advocating for any one of these things to be taken out of the definition per se, but it sounds like districts could be more creative with their funds by not including some of those in the definition. They could opt not to use some of those things. And do you see that being reflected well in your report, where they could define education differently and that cost to that good sold might be cheaper, or they might be able to put some more things into a subcategory and not have to assume that all those things have to be used in order to meet that goal?
Mr. Ames, please, briefly.
I will be brief, sorry. There is nothing in here that is requiring that any district spend anything on it. It is simply a tracking system. So it's after the fact. If somebody doesn't spend on something, then it just won't be there. It's not requiring that they do.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Chair Newman. Either Mr. Berkey or Mr. Ames, I haven't found the superintendents noted any place in the definitions. So is a superintendent, and I know administrative staff is accounted for, but is a superintendent and anyone in that leadership position not a part of teaching and learning? Is that why it's left out? But wouldn't that be important to include also someplace?
Mr. Ames.
It is included. It's in general and administrative, like a president or vice president of an organization. Those costs are. Go ahead.
Representative Erickson.
Oh, I'm still looking. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any further questions? Representative Sikora, I think we're completed, and it's your wish to lay this matter over for possible inclusion.
Yes.
Anything further?
Thank you.
All right, Representative Meslow, would you like to introduce your bill, please?
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. At this time, I would ask the opportunity to present House File 2738 to the committee, and I would be requesting that it be laid over for possible inclusion in our omnibus bill.
Okay. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, House File 2738 falls within the provisions of the Safe Schools Levy, and it strikes me that it's particularly appropriate for us to be addressing Safe Schools issue on the one-year anniversary of the Red Lake tragedy. Specifically, what we're talking about here are intermediate school districts. There is, as you know, $27 per pupil that is set aside for Safe Schools Levy to the districts throughout the state. And that money goes to those individual school districts. But the independent school, the intermediate school districts that we have have no independent ability to levy. And so they don't have any access to any of those funds as it stands right now. What House File 2738 would do would be to authorize additional levy authority to the school districts who participate in intermediate school districts. That authority would be up to $10 per student, but whatever was raised through that would be a pass-through directly to that intermediate school district so that they would be able to have access to the safe school funds to address safety issues within their buildings. It's really as straightforward as that. I have with me Superintendent Sandy Lewandowski, who would like to speak to the bill. We also have a video that shows some things that address the concerns within those intermediate districts. And I would say that those districts have at least as much concern about school safety issues and probably greater concerns, as you'll see from from the video.
All right. Did you wish to do a presentation first or the video first?
Short presentation.
Okay. Go ahead, Ms. Lewandowski. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much. Madam Chair, committee members, my name is Sandy Lewandowski. I'm the superintendent of Intermediate School District 287, which is a consortium of 13 West Metropolitan Suburban Districts. We have two other intermediates that ring the remaining size of the metro area in this state. The role of the intermediates on behalf of our members is to serve what we refer to often as low incidence needs for our members. That includes gifted education, career technical education, and a heavy component is special education needs. Increasingly over the last few years, our intermediate has experienced a change in student profile from our members sending us students, which we feel was very important to note to our school boards and to our superintendents. This fall, as I became superintendent, I believe that our school board was not fully appraised of the level of severity that we were seeing. And so we put together the videos we'd like to share with you this afternoon for their benefit. My impression of what has happened over the last few years within public service agencies at the federal and the state and the local level is that everybody is trying to do more with less. And many, many, many of those cuts at all three levels are resulting in an unprecedented level of student complexity coming into the public school system. I'm especially sensitive to the video I'd like to share with you today because of its topic and the areas it covers. As Representative Meslow says, on the anniversary of the Red Lake tragedy, It's important for me to note that we don't bring you this message lightly. It is the reality that we see in the intermediate. This video does contain some significant profanity in the middle of it, and I would alert you to that as you view it. So if the video is ready, I'd like to show it, and then we can take questions then and share.
All right. Proceed, please. I think this will give you an idea of what some of the intermediate districts are dealing with right now.
We want to educate the community at large and policymakers about the very real issue of children's mental health in our schools. This issue and provide solutions that are successful for kids and safe for staff. When a high-needs student enters our program, we often hear from the public, why isn't that student somewhere else? It's important for policymakers to understand that somewhere else is now our public schools. Intermediate District 287 is a consortium of 13 West Metropolitan School Districts. One of our major missions is to serve high-need special education students for our members.
The characteristics of our students are represented in some very alarming statistics. 90% of the students that we serve in our programs have been diagnosed with a mental health disorder. 86% of our students are currently receiving co-located mental health services. 70% of our students are currently taking psychotropic medications. And 57% of our students have been served in residential placements. 10 years ago, District 287 had two or three programs that were available for students with emotional and behavior disorders. Now, students that are referred to us are so much more complex and challenging in terms of their profile and their characteristics that we've had to create a multitude of customized programs that not only respond to all the behavior disorders, but the challenging multiple diagnoses, the psychotropic medications they may be on, the kind of environment that they need to be educated in, the types and number of staff that are required to get them through the day. So the whole picture of our division of special education looks very different today than it did 10 years ago due to the very different student population we're being asked to serve.
A lot of the students are coming to us not just with aggression issues, but a variety of mental health issues, ranging from depression to anxiety disorders, all the way to conduct disorder, oppositional defiant disorder, bipolar disorder, schizophrenia. At times we see students with schizophrenic symptoms. We have a student right now that is pregnant, that is an emerging schizophrenic, that is not medicated. And every day she walks in our building and has a difficult ride on the bus. She has a difficult time at the door. She comes in and she's screaming. She won't go to class. She is making accusations about someone touched her, someone kidnapped her, we're trying to make her lose her baby. And so we are trying to manage a female that is pregnant with mental health issues, and so many of those things are out of the realm of what we can do in an educational facility. We don't have security guards here. We don't have psychiatrists on staff, and we don't have the ability to say, this person has paranoid thinking, let's give them a particular med that can combat those particular symptoms.
One of the cases that I'm involved in right now with the suburban school district comes to mind. The student is, I think, as a lawyer, a very dangerous individual. He has repeatedly threatened to kill teachers. Most recently, he asked another student to prop open a lunchroom door so that he could sneak in during the lunch hour and kill two other students. This young man, whose characteristics really suggest a Columbine kind of situation, is in the community without mental health support, and the school is really struggling to attempt to provide him with some education.
Public schools have an obligation to see every type of child. Other entities do not. There can be many reasons to turn children away from a variety of placements, such as hospitals, therapy clinics, psychiatry offices, etc. Public schools must find a place for every child.
The thing that people need to realize with these students, especially EBD kids, too often because they appear to be quote-unquote normal kids, there's this perception that they intentionally misbehave and that they're naughty kids and they're intentionally difficult for staff, and that isn't true. If they had the skills or had the ability to maintain their behavior, they would. None of these kids walks around and gets up in the morning and says, hey, I'm going to get up and just be a jerk to the whole world today. They have a disability. They're not able to control those things.
I see staff in my district regularly who have scratches on their neck, bites on their arms, and who have been threatened verbally and physically by students.
It's not uncommon for me to have one or multiple accident reports to sign on a given day because staff are consistently exposed to pinching, kicking, hitting. We had staff having to go to the emergency room with having a phone that was, they were hit in the head, stitches, concussions. We have had students that have been so intense in terms of their behavior that we've had to rotate staff in, two staff in every hour so that they don't get burnt out and that we keep them safe and fresh, and it's a safe situation for the students and staff.
We walk so close to danger all the time. This is a dangerous situation just waiting to happen. So when you see the calm and the kids sitting at the table and the staff walking around and joking, it feels like, what's so bad? It looks like it's really working. But I can tell you one little thing. A chair moved wrong, a student bumped another student, a staff not hear a kid's request, and we could have not just a fight, we could have a riot.
I didn't realize how much was going to be damaging to my psyche is the amount of verbal abuse and how the dance would go on and on and on.
Don't get on my face,
I'm so mad
that hit somebody's fucking eye. I'm not complaining, man.
It is every single day. It's sort of, it's got really left off the day before.
Oh, yeah. Look, the fuck is getting, he's young as hell.
What I've seen lately is just there's a total disrespect with staff and the kids posturing, threatening staff. Before you guys came in, I was just reading a statement from a teacher who was threatened by a student yesterday.
Can you read that to us now?
Sure. Student next immediately began swearing profusely, saying, fuck that, fuck this shit, this is bullshit, motherfucker, I kicked somebody's ass, this bitches. I said, student next, to come on, it'll take this a few seconds. Student next said, quote, fuck that shit, don't give me no motherfucking minutes, whole ass.
Unfortunately, sometimes children who have mental health disorders act out against others. Most commonly, they're going to engage in behavior that's self-destructive. They're most harmful to themselves. But on occasion, they will lash out at others, and particularly children who have neurobiological disorders. This is not volitional behavior. It is part of their disorder. So our staff are at risk and often do have glasses broken. get scratches and bites, other physical injuries that have items thrown at them like chairs or books. That's the reality of a teacher's life in a classroom with children who are struggling with these various mental health issues.
Right now we have a very thin layer of mental health services that are co-located within some of our school programs. We understand that the funding for that is drying up very quickly, and we may lose 90% of the funding. That means we will have almost no co-located mental health services to serve these really high-need kids.
We have historically had a great funding base for co-located mental health services coming from local collaborative time study or LCTS monies. And those are monies that are federal flow-through Title IV-E monies that basically go to support the work that we do addressing children's mental health needs in schools. And lately we have learned that we are going to have those funds cut dramatically due to some changes in Title IV-E as well as in the Medicaid claiming process. And because of those changes, we're very concerned about losing the fiscal funding base for our co-located mental health services. As we look at this visual, you can see that most of the services provided are shaded in red. Due to impending funding cuts, we anticipate that about 90% of those programs will disappear.
The increased reduction of public money for human services has resulted in fewer placements within correctional and residential treatment facilities. School districts are the only entity that must keep their doors open to such students. Human service cuts were implemented in order to save public tax dollars. I believe they now inadvertently are being spent out of K-12 general fund budgets.
Oftentimes, young people end up in our system with a very high emotional, social, and fiscal price tag. If we had early interventions that were appropriate, we could end up saving taxpayers millions of dollars.
Complex mental health and special education needs of these students will not go away. To avoid them will only risk a higher cost to our society and our communities. I would urge policymakers at the local, county, and state level to join me in this policy dialogue to come up with solutions.
Madam Chair, I would just add that we took great precautions and made sure that we had all the associated data privacy permissions taken care of in this film. And we also, again, are very cognizant of some of the severity of issues shown in here, but felt that it's important to bring forward as a policy awareness the level of students and the complexity of their needs coming into our schools and the resources that are needed to address those, keep staff safe and students successful. I have brought with Dr. Char Michael Buss. Dr. Michael Buss works in our district as a administrator in charge of all the social, emotional, and mental health issues that we face, and she's available for questions as well.
All right, members, are there questions? Representative Newman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Mezel, in that film, what I saw was acts of violence, acts of threatened violence. What would appear to me, from a layman's standpoint, of students with mental illness, threatened criminal activity, that type of thing. And it doesn't seem to me to be that a public school would be the appropriate place to deal with those kinds of issues. So even if we pony the money up, and assume that we do, I really do question whether or not public school system is the correct place to deal with those kinds of issues, as opposed to hospitals or juvenile facilities or civil commitments, or you are aware of the gamut of those things that are out there. What are your thoughts on why would we want to deal with those issues in a school setting?
Madam Chair, Representative Newman.
Representative Maxwell.
Thank you. You raise a valid concern, and I guess as I look at the situation, the public schools still have the obligation to provide the education, and so those students are going to be there. What we're talking about with a bill like this is to address the overall environment. The public schools can't turn those kids away, can't turn those young people away and say, you're not welcome inside our doors. They're going to be there, and the application will be there for the schools to provide an education. Can they provide all of the mental health services necessary for those students? Probably not. What we're talking about here is providing sufficient support and services to make sure that the school is a safe environment for those students as well as their classmates. And the concern is there's such a tendency for, as funds trickle down, that when you're at the end of the stream, that's when there's very little water that still gets there. And the intermediate school districts truly are at the very end of the stream. It strikes me, particularly when I first saw the video, that as I look at what we're going to do, members, in a short session, in a non-funding session, that there's a very limited number of things that we need to do out of this Education Finance Committee. But it strikes me that ensuring that our schools are safe, that we don't, or doing all we can to make our schools safe and to prevent dangerous situations from occurring is maybe as important as anything that we can accomplish in the committee in this particular year. But I appreciate your concern. It's just that we can't turn them away.
Madam Chair, one quick follow-up.
Representative Newman.
Representative Neville, you're not suggesting, for instance, in that part of the film where the student asks someone to prop the door open so he can kill the people in the lunchroom, you're not suggesting that the school authorities are helpless from dealing with that student outside of the school building. The school authorities certainly have a right to discipline, do they not?
Madam Chair, Representative Newman.
Representative Meslow.
Thank you. Absolutely, there are disciplinary alternatives, and I don't know in that situation whether expulsion was the disciplinary alternative that was used. That was certainly one example, and I think the most extreme example of those that we saw in the video. But there are a number of incidents that don't rise to the level of expulsion, and certainly students and their families have rights before a student is expelled from the district, and that means that many of those students are going to remain in the district. And part of what the Safe Schools Levy is about, whether we're talking about the intermediate district or we're talking about overall school districts, is trying to provide the kind of environment in the building where that violence does not erupt. So some of it is certainly prevention oriented, and that in fact is the goal. Ms. Lewandowski, Superintendent Lewandowski may have something to add as well.
Ladies and gentlemen, we are going to pause briefly. We are to have a moment of silence today because of what happened at Red Lake last year at this time. So we would just say a silent prayer for 30 seconds. Thank you. Next question was Representative...
I think, Madam Chair, that Ms. Lewandowski was about to speak to Representative Newman's point.
All right. Ms. Lewandowski.
Thank you, Representative. In answer to your question, we provide for our members and also for other non-member districts in expulsion situations for special education students a placement that often is needed from a legal standpoint. Dr. Michaelbuss, could you just elaborate on that just a bit?
Madam Chair, Representative, when a child
Please introduce yourself.
Oh, I'm sorry. Dr. Charlene Michaelbuss, and I'm a supervisor of social emotional interventions and partnerships, basically mental health programs and chemical dependency programs in Intermediate District 287. And what I would like to comment on is that when a child is identified with a special education need, that child, of course, has a right to due process. If a child is expelled for a weapons violation or a threat of violence, we have an obligation in the public school world to find another appropriate educational placement, and that occurs while the child is awaiting trial and even perhaps post-adjudication, because oftentimes when a child has a mental health issue, they will be court-ordered to a treatment program of some sort, oftentimes a day treatment program, and even if it's a residential treatment program, we have an opportunity and an obligation to provide educational services to that child. So as public school people, we are always interacting with dangerous students no matter what the placement.
All right, Representative Clinton. Thank you.
Thank you. You had spoken, there. One thing I didn't understand was the frequent mention of co-located mental health services. And I was wondering if that means that there are county and other mental health or medical services that are being co-located in the school building, so these kids aren't going to and from different locations to get both their education as well as their therapies. Wasn't quite understanding that terminology that was being used. And secondly, the video referred to a loss of federal funds regarding Title IV and potential, like it's not there yet, but it's a concern, and whether or not, I mean, it doesn't seem to me like this levy would at all replace that, and how much of that would this replace? And the last thing I was just wondering was how much levy authority currently do the districts, these intermediate districts, have?
Ms. Lewandowski.
Madam Chair, Representative, in terms of co-located services, right now we do have a number of co-located mental health agencies on site that are used in conjunction and alignment with our special education programs to address the significant needs of these students. Those services right now are funded by what we call local collaborative time study money, which are a flow-through from federal funds. That is one of the sources of our major concern, in that we have been given indication that in all likelihood about 90% of those funds will vanish in the upcoming year, and therefore the money for those co-located services within our intermediate school district on behalf of our members would no longer exist. I believe I addressed your questions in there. If I missed something, please correct me.
Right. Madam Chair,
Representative
Clinton. I had a question about how much, though, of this levy would actually make up for that 90% loss of funds that you're concerned about, because it doesn't look like a lot when I look at the numbers.
Madam Chair.
Ms. Lewandowski.
Representative, we right now utilize about $1 million a year of local collaborative time study money. And so if this levy were authorized, the additional $10 would provide us some substantial relief for that money going away. We also utilize police liaison officers within a couple of our buildings. We would also need to expand that with some additional monies as well.
Madam Chair, I'd also ask what was the amount of levy authority you currently have in the intermediate district?
Our members, Madam Chair.
Ms. Lewandowski.
Representative, our members have a levy authority of $27 per pupil unit right now, and this bill would authorize an additional 10 to flow through to the intermediate.
So the other 27 is per school district, not for the intermediate.
Yeah, that was what I was asking. Do intermediate school districts currently have levy authority, and would this be flow through, or would this give the intermediate school districts maybe a new levy authority they don't currently have?
Madam Chair, Representative Finzen,
Mr. Strong.
The intermediates, for nearly all purposes, do not have levy authority on their own, and instead this would be flow through money that their member school districts would raise and then pass on to the intermediate school districts.
Madam Chair.
Representative Clancy.
So is this, are we setting new precedent in kind of dictating that this would flow through to the intermediate school districts?
Madam Chair, Representative Clancy, we've done similar kinds of things with the intermediates before, particularly with the health and safety levy, where we've allowed their member districts to take a portion of the costs for the health and safety and spread it within their member districts and then return that money to the intermediates.
Madam Chair.
Representative Clinton.
To the author, then, are we allowing this to happen, or are we pretty much directing the districts to flow this money through to the intermediate districts?
Representative Meslow.
Madam Chair, Representative Clinton, we are allowing the districts to do the levy and directing that if they do, that it flows through.
Thank you.
So the districts have a choice.
Madam Chair,
Ms. Lewandowski,
our members, as the individual just indicated, have an agreement for this kind of language. They understand the types of students they need placement for and have the agreement that they would flow the money through.
All right. Representative Biskins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, Representative Meswell, one would assume already that school districts are indeed flowing through SAFE school dollars as part of their payment to an intermediate school district. As I am a member of a school district and look at the SAFE school levy and look at its uses, some of the students that I would levy for are going to the intermediate. I have to pay the intermediate. Of course, all the dollars go into the general fund and go back out again, and no dollar is earmarked as it comes in from the taxpayers. We both know that. One of the issues then is, number one, they can technically do this already, all right? And so this is simply is those that are connected to intermediates. Actually, this is just saying you get $10 more per child. What about those school districts that are not connected to intermediates who won't get that, number one? And number two, what assurances are there that this new money wouldn't flow out to the intermediates, but the regular school district then hold back some of the old money that they used to flow out to the intermediates? Right? And then does this become a wash and the school district ends up with $10 more or $8 more per pupil?
Ms. Lewandowski, wouldn't you be billing back to school districts whatever costs are incurred by students they send you in any case, whether or not you have this crime levy or not, or the safe schools levy?
Madam Chair, yes, the nature of the intermediate tuition billing is indeed that we have done exactly that, basically take the program costs and bill them back to our members. I think what two unique things in this situation is that, number one, our member districts are experiencing higher need kids within their own programming, and kids that we used to serve even 3 or 4 years ago, we're seeing our districts try and serve now, so they certainly are using up, for the most part, their $27 just dealing with those young people back in their home district. Secondly, is that the Metropolitan District is a bit of a mecca for group homes, for example, and we see a disproportionate number of kids coming from outstate Minnesota, outside our own intermediate ranges often, then become the special education responsibility of those metro school districts. So we do see what I believe would be a disproportionate number and volume of those kinds of complex kids within the metro area as a result. One more thing would be just to address that is that, again, the very precipitating factor is what is this disappearance of mental health money as a result of a number of different cuts. And I think what would happen should the access to the $10 not be granted is that in order to keep at maximum safety requirements, which I need to be responsible for as a superintendent, the likelihood is that the tuition charges would be absorbing in the shifting of what was paid for out of human services or federal dollars into local school budgets by virtue of a tuition increase in tuition billing.
Thank you, Representative Bernardi.
Okay, I'll be real brief. I just wanted to know briefly, I was at two school districts, I visited my school districts, and they had mentioned that when they spend their dollars for their intermediate school, that it doesn't get counted towards classroom dollars, and that's why I was looking at you, because Greg, you might have to help me this with Tim. If the school district flows these dollars through, will they be penalized, and that won't be counted towards 70% classroom spending? Will it actually go against them?
Madam Chair, Representative Bernardi, I believe under the latest version of Representative Clemson's bill, the tuition payments, which I believe these would count as, are factored out of both the numerator and the denominator. So it would be, if it's considered a tuition payment, which I believe it would be, should have no bearing on the 70%.
Thank you.
Representative Greiling, final question.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. It seems like we have to fund this one way or another, and I'm kind of distressed that it's a safe school levy, but it clearly is an issue with children's mental health. But I wondered, I'm not sure if it would be the doctor or the superintendent, but one of you said on the tape, I think, or maybe it was in your testimony, that there are more children that we're trying to educate with mental health problems. Were they dropping out before, or what is the reason for that?
Madam Chair, Representative Greiling, what we see happening is that there is a reduction that is growing of out-of-home placements for young people, and so young people who used to be sent to residential placements at Rolling Acres or Northwoods, places like that, are no longer being placed in those residential facilities, and they're coming back into our local school districts. Our member districts don't have the capacity to support their mental health needs or their educational needs, and so then they're referring them to the intermediates.
I think that's as far as we can go today, so this bill will be laid over for probably more questions, but it will be laid over for possible inclusion. Representative House, I don't know how much time you thought your bill would take, but I know you didn't have witnesses. Do you want a quick run through your bill? Otherwise, we can do your bill first on the agenda tomorrow. How long do you need?
5 minutes or less.
Okay. Well, you have less.
The quicker you get someone to move it for me, the quicker we get out.
Okay, I would move your bill, 3247, before the committee for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Madam Chair, very simply, this is the safe school levy, somewhat what the previous group had, except where in many school districts across the state, and I think it's about 135, we want to change it so we can raise a minimum of $25,000 for a minimum of $25,000. Example, two of my school districts are having a great deal of difficulty with having a liaison police officer in school. And like the city of LaPorte, the school district of LaPorte, the city of LaPorte, they can only raise about $7,900, and it takes about $17,000 plus to do this if they get help from the county. The counties are backing down on this, so it's very difficult for some of these small school districts with large boundaries to raise the necessary funds for school safety. And I believe your wonderful staff has an amendment that will even decrease the fiscal impact of this bill were it adopted. The bill in its original form would cost about $1.5 million. And I see they're handing out the amendment. And I'm going to have staff help me because I'd like to even make it better.
Cheaper, you mean? Go ahead, Representative.
Well, I'll explain what I'd like to do, and Madam Chair, and you tell me if we can do that. On line 1.6, if we would delete its borders and insert the city where the school is located, then I will try to explain what I'm trying to do here.
Did you work on this? Mr. Stein, did you work on this? Another one? All right, you know what, Representative Howell? Is there somebody waiting? Jennifer, would you check? Is there somebody out there waiting to come in? All right, we've got two amendments which have to be explained, plus the whole concept of the bill. I'm going to suggest that we hold this over till tomorrow. I didn't realize we were going to have several amendments that would have to be explained, and there just isn't that kind of time.
Thank you.
So, Michael, you can have your room. Thank you, Representative Howell. You'll have to come back tomorrow.